lunch. My group is going to be slightly different. And I'll just say a couple of ways in which it will be different, I think, to what's come so far. The first thing is, within the context of building bridges and the careful attention to text, my paper will be quite sinful and transgressory, in the sense that I'm not going to actually mention any text whatsoever. The second point is that I want to try and think about some of the communal aspects for the topics that we're looking at. Quite a lot of what we've been discussing has been about the individual. And I'd like to raise certain things about how that individual is embedded within a community and how practices are communal, and also how individuals are memorialized and commemorated within the collective memory of that community as well. So, but before I get to questions around death, let alone attempt to analyze what that means, what it might mean to have a good death from a Muslim perspective, it's worth raising the difficult question of the horror of death. Death tends to scare most of us. And that, what is it that religion and also philosophy to a certain extent offers for us to deal with that horror? At least since Plato in the European metaphysical tradition and in the foundational scriptures of what became the Abrahamic faiths of the Near East, one of the central roles of religion was precisely to make sense of and overcome death, the corruption and annihilation of the flesh. We associate death with an end, a misfortune that strikes us, an evil that deprives us of the liberty of our life and existence, and is the pain we feel as we transition away from this world. A horror seems greater if we take death to be a final closure, and as the pain and evil that is inflicted, not just directly upon us, but also on those we leave behind, those who love us and whom we love. The radical idea that the Prophet Muhammad taught and proclaimed through the early revelations of the Quran was not that death was a certainty. I think pretty much most pre-Islamic Arabs understood that perfectly well. But rather that death was an opening to an afterlife. And the sudden shock of death associated in vivid imagery with both natural evils, such as earthquakes, and moral evils, such as witchcraft, require that humans understand the message from God, to recognize it, and to take on a moral obligation to live a good life, culminating in the good death, so that they may enjoy the fruits of that life and death in everlasting life thereafter. Two central cures were suggested for overcoming death. The first was the notion that a better understanding of reality would allow one to place death in a wider context, and that fleeing evil entails the seeking to replicate a rational understanding of the cosmos that is available to God, an apotheosis of the human in which death was merely a short step along the path to the One. A life seeking the truth dedicated to inquiry was therefore one way of overcoming the horror of death, seeking the face of God, and inculcating within the self the virtues of the divine or its counts in the Muslim traditions. The second contribution was to posit that true identity and personhood lay with the immortal soul that pre-existed and survived the death of the body, which in itself was a material thing which grew and wasted away. Our corollary to this is the acknowledgement that true life and death are not defined by the activity or lack of activity of the body. As Imam Ibn Abi Talib, the cousin and successor of the Prophet Muhammad, put it, people are asleep and when they die, they awake. Being in a state of wakeful awareness defined the opposite of death, and life was defined by the presence in the heart of the reality of God and the company of the friends of God. Similarly, the path to God had both an earthly element and a sense of the afterlife, and hence death was only a stage along this path. This is, therefore, not the worst that can happen to humans, as Plato put it, because it is not an end. Much of the pre-modern Islamic theological traditions are predicated on developing and disciplining the soul and the body with a sense of their radical contingency. And so since you And also because you heard quite a lot about text, as I said, I'm going to want to talk about text and move to memory and how it's enacted in terms of death and freedom rights and so forth. As I mentioned before, the idea is that the good death is very much a culmination of a good earthly life and a transition to the afterlife. It is the success of a believer whose heart, in the words of a famous saying attributed to the successors of the prophets, the imams of the Shi'i tradition, have been tested for faith. It is this believer who has been tested, Mu'min Muntahan, term in Arabic, whose good death is sought and becomes exemplary. It is such a believer who bears the cause of the friends of God, a cause that is difficult to sustain and is arduous. And therefore one cannot fail to locate this trial, within this life, to live a good life and to culminate it with a good death, understanding what that means, except through narratives of what such heroic lives and deaths are. And in this context, I want to mention three heroic lives and deaths, particularly three death stroke martyrdoms, which I think are significant within Muslim traditions. But a quick little caveat. Quite often, those of us in Islamic studies, and certainly those of us from a Muslim background, find it extremely problematic talking about martyrdom. Speaking about martyrdom raises all sorts of eyebrows and has, to be honest, people reaching for their phones to call the security services. And that's because martyrdom has unfortunately become associated with a type of end to life, which I would actually regard as quite nihilistic, and as an event in itself. Whereas the three cases I was talking about are very much about culminations, about how a particular end to physical life is more a fulfillment of that life, and it's not just a one-off event in itself. The first sacrifice for martyrdom is that of Abel, an unintentional sacrifice, because he didn't intend to die, and he wasn't expecting to be killed, and arguably the first crime of passion, in so much as both Cain and Abel are described in the spiritual traditions as vying with each other for the favor of the divine beloved. Abel's death is actually a rejection of violence and an embrace of true life beyond this world. It also bears a key moral without which it seems you would not know how to transition from this life. Cain's panic and despondency and sense of guilt at his act of fratricide is partially expiated by the little Quranic drama of the two ravens, which unfolds before him and guides him to the means of recognizing the death of his brother and preparing funeral rites and burial. Just to quickly explain, because I realize that this is just entirely Quranic and not available, it's not in the biblical tradition. Basically, what happens is Cain is distraught, he doesn't know what to do, he's got a body in front of him, what does he do with the body? And so the story goes that God sends two ravens down to the earth. One raven kills the other raven and then digs a little hole and buries the other raven in it. And so through this way of teaching, when God teaches Cain what to do, and it's the first act in which we understand what it means to bury someone. What do you do with the body in the very first instance? And so in this sense, every act of burial of the deceased that we then perform is an imitation and a recollection of this very first funeral. But it tends to be something which is very much lost in memory. We can come back to the issue of Cain and Abel perhaps later. The second sacrifice, of course, will be much better known. And it's in some ways a sacrifice which is aborted or at least postponed. And that is, of course, Abraham's sacrifice of his son. For many theologians and of course philosophers over the ages, this was precisely the most horrific trial imaginable for a father to be asked to sacrifice his son. The lesson of the good death implicit in this sacrifice was a central notion of patience and forbearance. And we will be
incredible applications before burials. As the son says to Abraham in the Brian account, he tells his father to carry out what he has been commanded, and he will find him, the son, to be patient. Such a sacrifice and embrace of a good death must be based on certainty and trust, and ultimately, of course, on love as well. Precisely those virtues with respect to the divine and to what comes after that we find most difficult to understand because of our sense of what we know in the here and now is often tied up in this world with what we have experienced. The very idea of accepting the truth of a vision to many of us nowadays certainly seems quite absurd. And yet, it is this particular sacrifice of Abraham, sacrificing his son, which is one of the central narratives which punctuate, through ritual enactment, the Muslim's life, Muslim's year, in fact, through its commemoration in the Hajj pilgrimage at the end of the lunar calendar year. As I mentioned before, this sacrifice of Abraham was one which is intended but was not fulfilled. It was aborted, or at least it was postponed. And what I mean by the postponement is, at the end of the passages in the Quran, which talk about the sacrifice, mentions that the sacrifice was ransomed by a great sacrifice, or a greater sacrifice. And over the centuries, exegetes have often wondered what this could mean, because the story that the son was replaced by a ram seems a bit strange. A ram doesn't seem to be a greater sacrifice than the son of the prophet. Particularly within the Shi'i tradition, the exegesis was that this was a reference to a future sacrifice, i.e. it was a reference to, of course, the sacrifice of the grandson of the prophet, Hussein al-Karbala. It is the martyrdom of Hussein al-Karbala, along with his family and a small group of companions, following the example of his father, Ali, who was also struck down and martyred in the act of prostration, and his brother Hassan, who was poisoned before him as well, which indicates how acts of sacrifice indicate a life which culminates in a particular way, and which presents for us the way, the example of the friends of God. The association between this good life and good death is actually memorialized in there's a very famous kind of car sticker you can get called Live Like Ali and Die Like Hussein. It's very popular in Shi'i communities around the world. And it tends to, in a slightly kind of pithy and way, encapture this particular sentiment. The witnessing of Hussein, the pathos of the situation, is a passion of many a play, and an enactment in which the very narrative of Karbala provides a frame for understanding what constitutes good and evil, what constitutes life and death, what constitutes patience and forbearance. And these are enacted in annual commemorations, of course, in the month of Muharram, in which believers relive this particular type of sacrifice and through that understand what the good death is. And yet there's very much about the story of Karbala which goes against some of what we might assume funerary rites and so forth existed, consistent. For example, the body of the martyrs lay on the sands unburied for days. And yet, despite this seeming humiliation with respect to the bodies, once those bodies were then buried and became shrines over time, they became fundamental sites, sacred sites, to which believers flocked. Believers flocked not only to actually bury their own dead, to allow their dead to be in close proximity to the bodies of the friends of God, but also to for that sacred space and for that person, that saint who was buried there, to then act as an intercessor for them and for their particular wishes that they have. And then one example, for example, of this is the shrine of Ali ibn Abi Talib himself in Najaf. Next to it has probably the largest cemetery in the world, which is known as Wadi Salam, the Valley of Peace. Now, the mourning for Hussein, which is enacted every year at least, is much more than just an act of redemptive suffering, much more than just a site for understanding Christology in Islam, in which Hussein takes on the person and function of Christ. And Mahmoud Ayyub, for example, has written about this. Mourning is a response to the gift of martyrdom and hope carried on to the eschaton. Whenever someone dies within the community, part of the funerary ceremonies include the convocation of mourning sessions for Hussein, in which the story is retold and connected to the death of the deceased. The pain and the evil that the family feel at the loss of their beloved therefore pales in significance with the loss of the beloved friend of God, but also allows for a cathartic release for the family. It brings the community together to share in the grief and to at least attempt to alleviate some of the burden of that grief. And then at every level, through the funeral prayer and the ceremonies around the burial, Karbala is invoked and enacted. The funeral prayer leader testifies on behalf of everyone present that we know nothing but good about the deceased, that regardless of the manner of their death, they lived good lives in faith, in remembrance of the friends of God, and hence they died a good death. The body is shrouded by cloth, which is often acquired from Karbala, with talismanic prayers meant for a person and the memory of Hussein. As the body is lowered into the grave, usually the son or a similar intimate of the dead person addresses them and recites the talqeen, a creedal prayer in which the dead person is prepped for the questions in the grave and told to remember that they are lovers of the Prophet and his family, and as such can never be ultimately harmed by the horror of the grave or the consumption of the fire. A small clay tablet of earth from Karbala, which is normally used in prayer, prostration, is placed on the chest to symbolize the intimacy and the location of Karbala in the heart of the deceased. And sometimes also a handkerchief which that person might have used to wipe away their tears during the annual mourning commemorations for Hussein. So these are all signals to remind those burying the person of the links to the sacred and to death as a transition into the presence of the divine and the company of God's friends. And it's also a signal for the believers when they come to the grave that basically he's one of us. Leave him alone, be good to him, and go easy. Through the life of the grave, the lovers of Hussein enjoy the beatitude and the taste of what is to come in paradise. When they are raised, the daughter of the Prophet intercedes for them and ushers them into paradise, where their actual paradise is enjoying the face of the divine and the company of the friends of God again. Both the resurrection and the final destiny are corollaries to the good life and death of the believer. However, the death of the body is not the closing of the book as such, to use the metaphor of the scriptures, on the worth of the person. Rather, as the famous saying of the Prophet states, a person continues to flourish in the grave and beyond through the good works committed in the world, through acts of charity, through benefits established in the world, and of course through children who continue to bear witness to truth and serve their fellow humans. But above and beyond that, a number of theologians have actually talked about how if the individual continues to flourish. For example, the religious thinker I worked on primarily in Mulla Sadra in the 17th century argues that the very essence of the human It is the very essence of the human to seek perfection and the good, because that's what constitutes the innate nature of the person in the soul. And the soul is an immortal element. It always has existed and it always will exist. And since it is an immortal element which ultimately comes from the divine, it has some of the elements of the creative power of the divine. So after the death of the body, and with the resurrection and the two resurrections, we can go into that perhaps later. Because the soul has a certain creative force linked to the divine command, it doesn't die, but tastes death. It was mentioned earlier, everyone shall taste death. And at the resurrection and beyond, then recreates a perfect projection of the body with which it was associated within this world. And that's one of the ways in which Buddha Sadhu tries to grapple with this
really fundamental problem about how you provide a serious philosophical argument for corporeal resurrection, which is something which most theologians found real trouble with. Now, such a radical dualism of the person, what sort of implications might that have? And I want to just, to end, just consider one ethical implication that it might have. Most believers are probably uncomfortable with an entirely metaphorical reading of the scriptural descriptions of the spaces of human destiny, whilst understanding that entirely literal and physical interpretation is also difficult to defend. And yet religious life is not just about ideas and doctrine. The one notion that we have in liberal post-enlightenment societies that restrict faith to matters of belief that are introspectively held, challenged and rationally defended, seems to be belied not only by a psychology of choices that we make that are not always entirely rational, but also by the importance of ritual to symbolize and enact faith. And this is precisely one of the reasons why I've tried to invoke both narratives and how they relate to rituals that are enacted. The question is, what does this have to say, how does this speak to us with respect to how we deal with a body as it's moving towards death? And of course, the obvious question I'm raising here is, broadly speaking, a question of what we might call euthanasia. And I'm just going to make a couple of suggestions of how we might approach it. And I'm sure many of you will disagree with me. The question of euthanasia, stroke, assisted suicide. One's perspective ultimately does really depend on the terminology that you use. Clearly, suicide is not something condoned in most, if not all, forms of Islamic theological reasoning. And certainly, in that context, the idea of an assisted suicide will simply find difficult ground for a positive reception. However, euthanasia is predicated not only on the possibility of the autonomy of an individual's reasoning, but also how we tend to feel about pain and self in the modern period. If the foundational myth of the modern person is this notion of negative liberty, that we ought not to be constrained or coerced in what we choose to do, then this raises both the sense of entitlement that we feel towards pleasure and the sense that we have a right not to feel pain, because pain is seen as an infringement upon our liberty. But such a liberal notion of self-autonomy would not, which in itself is an extreme notion, modified liberal tradition arguably would not uphold, is at odds with most forms of Islamic theological reasoning, which rejects such a form of individual autonomy, which is entirely devoid of a context, entirely devoid of a communal setting context for the performance of moral agency. Returning to the idea that we discussed earlier, the believer whose heart is tested in faith, pain is not an end in itself or a state to be considered in isolation. It could be that pain in the short term leads to pleasure in the longer term, taking into consideration both the direct victim of the pain as well as indirect victims such as family and friends affected by a terminally ill person. Pain is recognized as a basic form, a basic fact of human life. To live with the assumption that it's an infringement on the self or that it can be wholly expunged is actually rather naive. Even if we were able to extinguish moral pains and evils, natural pains and evils, of course, would still remain and would still allow for the possibility of both goodness and pleasure to flourish in human life. Of course, these are all points arguably against euthanasia. But if the body of this life does decay and is corrupted, and since medical practitioners often make decisions that many of us would recoil from in everyday life, and if the true self resides in the soul with the creative power to act as the instrument of God and recreate the body at resurrection and beyond, then does a momentary decision that we may make in this life have ultimate implications for human destiny? Can we decide to terminate the life of a body knowing full well that the soul will revive it in the afterlife? Such a theory may provide one possible way of opening the door for euthanasia,
And there's actually a growing Islamic juridical literature which tries to deal with such bioethical problems increasingly openly and with certain elements even of ambiguity. The real problem, it seems, relates not just to the person suffering who wishes to end the life of the body, but to the wider context, to the friends, to the relatives, and to society which does not wish to see such a choice as the good death, regardless of the actual term used for this. And indeed sees this as an arrogation of the liberty that humans do not possess. Another obvious problem with this theory is that ontological niceties with respect to dualism do not necessarily convince people, because we don't always make straightforward rational choices, as I mentioned before. So even if you were to say to someone who is seeing a loved one in that situation, look, it doesn't really matter, because ultimately it's a soul which counts, and that soul will recreate that body and will live in bliss and beatitude with the divine of God. I wonder to what extent that could possibly be any sort of comfort. The dilemmas posed from bioethics require us to think and respond theologically in a manner that is consistent with how we understand and act to memorialize the good death. The narratives of sacrifice and martyrdom at the time are discussed provide hooks through which we may approach the problem, but I'm not pretending to offer an answer. I merely raise a few questions and realize that the theological responses that we're seeking are not primarily about what I would consider the smaller theological questions to be, such as the nature of God, the small theological question. The bigger theological questions are about human experience. They're about the horizontal, not the vertical. But ultimately about how those problems should be approached through referring back to those narratives of the friends of God. And that's really the theme I want to stress. We've heard a lot about God individual. We haven't so far heard about the context community. And certainly the very important role that the notion of friends of God play within Islamic traditions. Thank you.